From KMUW Studios and part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Books and Whatnot. I'm Suzanne Perez, KMUW's resident book reviewer.
And I'm Beth Golay, host of KMUW's Marginalia Podcast. This podcast was recorded on July 23rd, 2024. Any references to new or forthcoming and the like are relative.
Hey, Beth.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
It is July. There's lots to talk about today.
July. Isn't that a book title?
Is it?
Huh?
Oh, July.
Let me look up the author.
Well, we'll look that up and add it to it. It'll be the first book mentioned in the show notes. this month, you know, as we have done the past couple episodes, we have an independent bookseller that we talk to about upcoming releases. And I'm very excited to say that our guest this month is Jennifer Kassebaum. She owns Flint Hills Books in Council Grove, Kansas.
That's right. We've visited with her before. That was our first and only road trip, sadly.
Right. And we're about to go on another one.
That's right.
No, Jennifer's store there in Council Grove is in an old bank building, and it is just super cool and charming. She has a beautiful painting up of local artist, big old painting in her bookstore, and the restroom is in a vault, as I recall.
Is it?
Isn't it? Anyway.
Well, we'll find out.
but she is excited to talk to us about August releases.
That's
and
right.
we're going to be thrilled to have her. We thought we'd start out this episode today by talking a little bit about what every single book person I know is talking about or sharing on social media, and that is the New York Times Book Review's big old monster list.
The best books of the 21st century so far.
Right. So the New York Times Book Review editors decided to put out a call to more than 503, I think the odd number is, a big old number of, you know, today's luminaries, authors, artists, people in the know, as well as their own editors and contributors. And they've come up with a list of 100 of the best books of the 21st century so far. So these are books that have been published since 2000. They put them in a wonderfully, as the New York Times does, interactive.
Yes, I love that.
Me too. So you can go down the list. If you haven't seen this, absolutely Google it and check it out. You're able to, as you go down the list, and it goes from 100 down to 1, you're able to mark whether you've read it and then whether you want to read it. And at the end, it gives you this screenshotable image of the books that you've read. Now, I am embarrassed to say I've only read 23 books on this list.
Well, you know, I was very excited about this list because I started as the marketing manager at Watermark Books in 2001. So this is my whole era of reading. I thought I was going to just be on top of it. Now, I recognized all but maybe 2 books.
Now, that's
there.
Better than me. There are so many on there I had never heard of.
I had only read 22.
Ah, I beat you by 1.
Yes, but now I'm up to 23 because I decided.
Because you're so competitive.
Yeah, kind of. Yes, I am. I decided, okay, I'm going to read these. See why.
You know we love a list.
So I read the first one.
Right, the number one book.
The number one book was My Brilliant Friend by Elena Ferrante, which was the first of 4 books in the Neapolitan series, and it came in at number one. It was on my shelf, so I read it.
Yeah, it was interesting to me. As they often do, there's a lot of sort of offshoot stories that went along with the main list. And first of all, they told the people contributing, the people who voted, basically, these 503 people, they told them their list of their top 10 would be anonymous. But then they asked them if they'd like to share, and many, many of them did, including Stephen King, who voted for one of his books. And I love that. I love it. It's one of the top 10 books of the century so far is Under the Dome by Stephen King. I love
that's so
that
funny.
Chutzpah, but you know, he backs it up. But no, so to look on these lists and to see how many people put, is it Elena Ferrante? How do you say the author's name?
I don't know. I think it's Elena.
Elena. I always want to say Eliana, but anyway, it's Elena Ferrante.
It's E-L-E-N-A.
Well, it's not her real name anyway. Right?
True. And I think that was part of the shtick is that nobody really knew who this author was when the books came out. I think maybe we know now, although I couldn't tell you who it is. Did she ever reveal?
I don't know
her
that she
identity?
Has.
Okay.
I don't know that she has. And that's, it was a whole phenomenon when these books were coming out. It was very, you know, it was one of those books that a lot of people had in their hands, and you saw it in a lot of airports and things like that.
And it came from Europa, which is a really reputable...
Bougie.
Yeah, publisher.
Publisher, yeah. And they are supposedly beautiful books. I will at least read the first one. I'm not big on series, but, you know, if I must go on, I must.
Well, I read it to meet you at 23, yes, but then also to see what the fuss was about. And
yeah.
No.
I know. Well,
especially not number one on that list. There are so many others on that list.
Okay. So what would you have put as number one?
Well, I know that's that's not fair.
I know it's not a fair question. Because there were also, and then this has since come out, since the main list was published, a lot of people have said, oh my gosh, there's so many great books that weren't on that list. And some of it has to do with, you know, Stephen King, for instance, does not have a single book on that list. And people have said that it's because he wrote so many that it kind of splits the vote.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So,
but then what happened? They asked for readers to submit their own?
So readers, and you can still do this. You can go on online and vote for your 10 books. And when they put those together, of those, I read 48 of the 100.
So I think mine was 39.
Yeah, so it's many, many more than from the original list. But that list had things like, which I couldn't believe was not on the original list, A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles, A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara, some really,
Cutting
really,
for Stone.
Cutting for Stone, which I still need to read.
Right.
Yeah, those I couldn't believe were not on the first list. But
I'd like to go through that list and get credit for the ones that are on my shelf.
Yeah. Oh, God, me too. I would. Like I told you, there were so many I had not recognized. The one I want to get to soonest, in fact, is called The Known World.
Edward P. Jones?
Yes, Edward P. Jones, yeah. The Known World. It came in at number 4.
It won the Pulitzer.
Won the Pulitzer. I had never heard of it.
And then his follow-up to that was All Aunt Hagar's Children. And was that on there as well, or was
I
that
don't
on the...
believe so.
Okay.
But I did not recognize this book whatsoever. The cover did not look familiar to me. It was published early on in the century. But I immediately went out to my local friendly used bookstore, found a copy for a few dollars, and that is going to be definitely at the top of my TBR.
Yeah, that was an amazing book.
Yeah. So any other thoughts on those lists?
I found it interesting. Not that I want to stir up a brouhaha, but it was interesting to see the authors on there who had multiples, and especially Alice Munro after that.
It was obviously before the latest news about her.
Exactly.
If you are not familiar with what has happened there, Alice Munro, the famed short story writer who passed away this year, very recently.
In January, I believe.
Her daughter recently came out in an expose article and has since gone on to a lot of news outlets talking about how the daughter had been abused by her stepfather for many years, and that Alice Munro allegedly was aware of it and did nothing. It is, you know, it makes me again want to read, which I will, Monsters by Claire Dederer. Which is, it's called Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. It came out last year, I believe. It's a nonfiction book about how you reconcile these horrible things happening with, you know, artists whose work you love or respect. Neil Gaiman has also been in the news lately, accused of sexual assault.
Oh, wow.
So I'm just like, these are beloved, award-winning, highly respected writers, and what do you do with that? You know, how do you see their work in that light?
A lot of people are talking about rereading Alice Munro or going back if they've read it and looking at these books with this information in hand, and you have this whole new context through which you're reading this book, and I just think that is fascinating.
Yeah, that is one way to deal with the work, too, is just to say this has happened and this is new knowledge that we have about, you know, what could have been happening during the writing of this particular short story or whatever. But yeah, you're right. She did have at least two,
if not
collections.
Three. Right. Jesmyn Ward had three.
Yeah.
George Saunders had
three, right? Me. Yes, he had three. He had two short story collections, one of which I hadn't heard of. Of course, I've heard of 10th of December. Mm-hmm. I had not heard of Pastoralia. Pastoralia. Anyway, I recently got it on another great deal for that one, and that's going to be my collection that I read for the Read ICT Challenge.
Nice.
I think it's a short story collection, but one of the New York Times editors said it was really funny and really strange, as George Saunders tends to be. And then he also, of course, was recognized for Lincoln and the Bardo, his novel. Is that his only novel? I believe it is.
I believe so. And then he has that Swim in the Pond in the Rain,
right,
where he looks at Russian short story writers,
right,
and he basically gives you a master class. You read along with him, and he basically has his lecture in there on these short stories.
Yeah,
so if you want to take a class from George Saunders.
The New York Times editors, they've also done a podcast. Definitely look it up. It's called the New York Times Book Review Podcast. They had a whole episode on this list where they talked about their thoughts about it, and one of their thoughts was that George Saunders was on there so much because several of his students were the ones voting.
Yeah, I found that interesting as well.
Including Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, the author of Chain Gang All-Stars. I believe he had at least two, if not more, George Saunders works on his list. So it's a fabulous resource. It's a great list to sift through if you love to read. Obviously, it leans heavily toward literary fiction. I think around 23 or 25% of the books are nonfiction. A lot of those were memoir, a couple of big old biographies like the LBJ work was on there. It's fascinating to sift through. Don't feel bad if you haven't read many of them.
This is just one of those fun things, like, you know how we like book concierge because mm-hmm. we get to go through there. But this has that interactive element where you get to check off the list, much like the 1,000 Books to Read Before You Die by James Mustick, it has the checklist in the back. So this is just kind of fun. It's
right.
a fun exercise.
For people who like to read every Pulitzer since 2000
right.
or whatever. But yeah, it's definitely going to be something that I refer to when I'm wondering what I should read next. Why not?
Yeah.
You know, go back a few years anyway, back to 2000.
Exactly.
25 years.
All right. So what have you been reading this past month?
What have I been reading lately? Okay. The first book I'd like to talk about this time is The Cliffs by J. Courtney Sullivan. J. Courtney Sullivan, I have not read her before. This was my first work of hers that I've read. She's published a book titled Maine, Friends and Strangers, several others. This is one I picked up at the recommendation of a bookseller. I also love a good family drama. This one is set in Maine, so it makes a wonderful summer read, first of all. It centers on an old Victorian house, a purple house, literally is on a cliff overlooking the coast of Maine in this tiny town. And our main character is Jane Flanagan. She is coming off of a pretty rough patch of her life. Her marriage is in trouble. Her job is on pause. There's been an incident in her workplace that basically has her reevaluating her life. And she moves back to her hometown. And in this town, there's this house that throughout her childhood, she has used as sort of her personal refuge. She discovered it. It was abandoned. She peeked in the windows and realized it looked like someone had just up and left and not even packed up all the belongings. There was still, you know, a dollhouse in the corner and there was still stuff on shelves. And anyway, but she loves the view from this place and there's no one around. And she kind of uses this to go and read. And she sort of develops a relationship with this house. When she comes back to town many years later, she realizes that someone has HGTV'd it, basically.
Oh, no.
A woman named Genevieve, who's a summer resident of the town, so that you have the townies and the tourists, and there's that sort of conflict going on. But Genevieve has bought the house and is renovating it. But some things have happened. I don't want to give away any spoilers, but some things happen along the way of that renovation, and there are what Genevieve thinks are spirits in the house, and she wants to figure out the history of it. And Jane is an archivist with a library at Harvard University. They meet each other, and basically Jane starts kind of working for her because she has nothing else to do, so she's researching this house. What follows is really a wonderful, complex story about the history of this house through the generations, starting with the native people of that region and up through, there's a lot that I learned about Quakers and Shakers, and it centers on women especially who have lived in this house and the different challenges they have had through the years. And so as Jane goes on her own personal journey, she's also researching and learning about other women, including women in her own life, her ancestors. So it was a really great read. It's a long novel. It's pretty hefty. And that, like I said, there's a lot of things in there, but it was truly satisfying. It was a great summer read, I thought. And I really liked it. I also reviewed it. My review is on KMUW.org.
So when we go back and we learn these past histories, are we learning them in like the present time? Is this like a Northwoods type book,
or it's not necessarily. Well, it's a little of both. I mean, you go back and there's definitely a going back in time kind of thing,
okay,
with certain characters, different incidents in the house and surroundings. It is very Northwoods now that I think about it. Northwoods by Daniel Mason, a novel I loved, and largely because the setting was such a character, mm-hmm, in that novel. And in the same, yeah, this is very similar to that. And yeah, you see it from a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different time periods, and you learn, it's definitely historical fiction. You learn a lot about American history through that journey. So that's The Cliffs by J. Courtney Sullivan.
It kind of reminds me of People of the Book by Geraldine Brooks.
Right. I haven't read that one.
If I remember right, this copy of the Haggadah was found, and she was like flown into Bosnia to like not repair it or restore it, but just prevent any more damage. And so like she would cut the spine, and inside might be this piece of rice, or that might be this feather, or it might be this grain of salt, or this tear that had fallen on the book. And then each one gets its own story.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me a little bit
of that. I love Geraldine Brooks.
Yeah, who doesn't?
I know. I need to read that one.
And the only other thing I wanted to say is I have interviewed J. Courtney Sullivan for Saints for All Occasions.
Oh, yeah. So look for that on the Marginalia podcast. Very good. Okay, so what's your first book, Beth?
My first book is The Wide, Wide Sea by Hampton Sides. I interviewed Hampton Sides once before for his book On Desperate Ground, which looked at a particular battle during the Korean War. And I was very honored that he requested to speak with me again for this one. And so The Wide, Wide Sea focuses on the third and final voyage of Captain James Cook. You can see the influence of Cook in like Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. It's thought that Melville was inspired by Cook for Moby Dick. And Hampton Sides explains that Captain James Cook was an amazing cartographer. He could draw maps, and he wouldn't even have to go to land to do it. He could do it from the sea. And what was amazing was if you look at the maps that Cook has drawn and compare them to satellite images, they are remarkably accurate. And so Cook was beloved by his men. He didn't have a single case of scurvy in all three of his voyages.
They had plenty of citrus aboard.
Yeah, nobody knew at that time. This book is filled with all of these, oh, let's give him more wine, it'll stop scurvy. Oh, let's give him this, it'll stop scurvy. And he just somehow figured out that fresh fruits and vegetables was necessary. He did indicate that something changed in Cook in the final voyage. He got angry faster, and historians really don't know what it was, but they think it might have been health-related. But he was tasked with this third voyage of finding the Northwest Passage. And so Cook and his men were explorers. They often overstayed their welcome. And Cook began to question these voyages and disruptions to indigenous people. And then this was Cook's final voyage because he came to a violent end at the hands of the Polynesian people on the Big Island of Hawaii. So that's why this ended Cook's exploration.
Wow.
But it was just a fascinating read. You know, I don't read enough nonfiction, but I always appreciate it when I do. I do think I gleaned a few nuggets for trivia.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, Hampton Sides always delivers just a great creative nonfiction read. So that is The Wide, Wide Sea by Hampton Sides.
We have a lot of maritime nonfiction lately with
Ask
The Wager.
Who named the Pacific?
Who named the Pacific
Do
Ocean?
Do you know?
No, I don't.
Oh.
Do you know?
Magellan.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, see, I'm learning. So this is how we learn.
And apparently it was really smooth when he found his spot of the Pacific, because why else would you say something was pacified?
Right. No kidding. No kidding. Well, that yeah, that sounds great. And yeah, it reminds me of a lot of The Wager by
yes.
David Grann. And I just have to say, I believe you brought that book today to just continue your Moby Dick trend.
Oh.
Every episode has to mention Moby Dick.
Yeah, until I read the damn thing, yeah.
Subconscious. My next book is Pierce Oysters by Jocelyn Takacs. It's spelled, her last name is spelled T-A-K-A-C-S, but apparently that last C is silent, so it's Takacs. So it is set in Louisiana during the 2010 BP oil spill. Do you remember the...
Well, have you seen...
Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah. Have you seen... Aaron Sorkin wrote it, and it was called Newsroom.
Oh, no.
The first episode focuses on that BP Horizon.
I've seen portions of that episode, but yeah. So it was obviously a huge environmental disaster. This novel centers on a family, the Pierces, who harvest oysters out of the Gulf. Basically, the main character is a 35-year-old man, Jordan Pierce. After the sudden death of his father, he is like sort of the unwilling head of the company now, kind of doesn't really want to be doing this for the rest of his life, but also sees the way he makes his living and the way his family has made his living for generations. And then when the Deepwater Horizon oil rig suddenly explodes off the coast of Louisiana, he is, you know, has to grapple with a lot of fears and anger. And it's an incredibly told story because the story sort of mimics the spill itself. Mm. I mean, it's just very slow, mysterious. We don't know the extent of a lot of these people's issues until a little bit of time has passed. And in that same way, you know, so Jordan has a brother who sort of escaped the small town coastal life and oyster farming for a life in New Orleans as a musician. He's kind of a beatnik guy. He comes back to help out, to help Jordan get all the oysters harvested that they can before the oil really spreads to them. It's an incredible exploration of both the environmental cost of this thing, but also sort of how that affects individual people. And it's really well told. I was not familiar with Jocelyn Takacs. I think this may be her debut novel. I'm pretty sure this
is
her.
Yeah, I'm not familiar.
Yeah, this is her debut novel, and it's really well done. Lots of interesting side characters. Again, a really new look at something that happened, you know, a while back now, but it's really pretty recent history. And then, of course, you know, I went down the rabbit hole, you know, of doing research about that oil spill and how it was handled. And oh my gosh.
Halliburton.
You can read a lot about that. But this is about family jealousies. There's addiction struggles in here. The grief from Jordan's perspective of losing his father, but also his mother's grief. And she really successfully juggles it all. She's a wonderful writer, and high compliments for this novel. Again, perfect summer read because it's coastal and beachy and really puts you in an interesting place and time. So that's Pierce Oysters by Jocelyn Takacs.
Okay, my next one is The History of Sound by Ben Shattuck.
Yay.
It's a collection of linked stories. The links are either artifacts or people or a place. And it's also a study of every type of short story style one can use to tell a story. One of the more unique styles in the book was a script of Radiolab.
Oh,
but if
yay.
You listen to the audiobook, it's an actual episode of Radiolab, and the actors sound exactly like the hosts.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, I read the first story, the title story, The History of Sound, with my short story group. It was published in The Common, it comes out of Amherst University. And it didn't disappoint the second time I read it. If you Google The History of Sound, you're not likely to find the story or even the collection, because instead you're going to find information about the movie that is based on the first story, The History of Sound. And it's actually Ben Shattuck wrote the screenplay. He's kind of a Renaissance man. He's a writer. He's an artist. He's a museum curator. He owns the oldest continuously run grocery store in the country.
What?
And he's married to Jenny Slate. So
oh my gosh.
I told him, I did not include this in the interview because I really don't if I love a book, I don't want to say I love a book. If I don't love a book, I can't say I don't love a book. I'm not the reviewer. I talk to the authors. But I did tell him off sound that this book was perfect. Wow. I loved it.
I can't wait to read it. So this is another collection possibility.
Yes, but they're linked. And go ahead.
Well, so we often say interconnected short stories like Tommy Orange's They're There, but you're saying these are more a little bit more separate than that.
Right. Like let's take this script from Radiolab, because they're trying to find the great auk, and it's about these sightings of the great auk on this island off the coast of Newfoundland.
Is that a bird?
Yes.
Okay.
And so you might have a recording from the past or a phone call from a ornithologist who lives in Canada. And so it sounds like a really good history. Mm-hmm. And then she says, but then there's this photo and you see this great auk and you see this egg in the nest. And that just tells me that they are not extinct. The next story goes back to how that photo was taken.
Oh,
so
neat.
They're only connected by that one thing.
Right. Oh, that's very
cool.
And they,
you know, no story is like the other. This, oh gosh, I do recommend listening to this because it's just, it was a highly produced audiobook. Thought was put into this audiobook. Actors, the two actors that are going to be in the History of Sound movie also read a couple of the chapters. I don't know. It was Nick Offerman reads a couple of the chapters, or at least one.
So you highly recommend the audio. Did you listen and read at the same time?
Yes,
did you do
that's
that?
What
okay.
I do.
Yes, the dual format.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, that's on my list as well.
The History of Sound by Ben Shattuck.
Awesome. My next one is what is quickly becoming what I think is the book of the summer, and that is The God of the Woods by Liz Moore.
Mm-hmm.
You also talked with Liz Moore for the Marginalia podcast, so check that out. I have reviewed this one on KMUW. This is a chunk of a book. It is Liz Moore's. She's written several novels. It's the first one I've read of hers. The premise is at a summer camp in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York, a camper goes missing. The counselor looks at all the beds first thing one morning and realizes that Barbara Van Laar is missing. And Barbara Van Laar is not just any camper. She is the daughter of the founder of the camp, the owner of the camp, a very prestigious family, the Van Laar family in that region. And not only that, this camper that has gone missing, her older brother, Bear, had gone missing in this same area 14 or 16 years prior. So, wow.
Yeah.
What a premise. You have these dual mysteries happening where we're trying to find Barbara. We don't know what is behind her disappearance. There's all the folklore around this part of the region, including a serial killer on the loose.
Yeah.
We have, you know, counselors that are, you know, suspected. You know, the family is very rich, and a lot of this book is rich people behaving badly. But then you also go back and learn about the disappearance of Bear, her brother. So it was one of the most propulsive books I have read in quite a while. I was telling Beth, in fact, while I was reading this, it is very seldom that I will, I don't want to say skip out on work, because I didn't really. If anyone at work is listening to this work podcast. But there was a moment toward the end of this book where I just had to listen to it. And I got away for half an hour and just read the rest of it, because listen to the rest of it. It was that good. Like, I could not pull myself away from this book. It was so, so good. Her writing is outstanding. The way the story sort of seamlessly develops and then comes to what I thought was an incredibly satisfying and surprising ending.
Mm-hmm.
So that is God of the Woods by Liz Moore. Highly recommended. Yeah, I just can't say enough good things about this book.
I really loved her exploration of, you know, the haves versus the have-nots, and how the town has completely supported the Van Laar family throughout history, and how they, I don't know. It was just very interesting that this is multi-layered.
Yes.
It's not just a, oh, a camper goes missing and there's a serial killer on the loose. That seems like the most campy part of it was really well done.
Oh, and you know, the fact that the Van Laar family, yes, gets lots of help from locals to build this grand residence, which they then call Self-Reliance.
Yes.
Just the irony is thick here, but every character is complex. You know, there are characters that you definitely loathe. There are characters you love and root for, but you don't know. You don't know so much about them until it unfolds, and it's fantastic. God of the Woods, Liz Moore.
I will say that when I spoke with her, she was on set of the movie they were shooting of another book that she wrote, and I don't remember which one was.
Long Bright River?
That doesn't sound familiar, but she also...
The Unseen World?
She also has that Renaissance quality about her.
Yeah. Like the Unseen World and Long Bright River I own. Ding, ding, ding.
Okay.
So I may have to go back into her backlist and explore her a little bit more.
Okay, so my next book is called The Heart in Winter by Kevin Barry. Kevin Barry is very Irish. If you listen to my interview with him, you'll understand that. And this is about an Irish immigrant living in Butte, Montana, who falls in love with another man's mail order bride.
Oh.
And the pair run away from the jilted husband, who will do whatever it takes to stop them.
Dun, so, dun, dun.
Yeah, so much of this book is about the two of them on the lam, the hardships they endure throughout this harsh Montana winter as they try to make their way to San Francisco. And Kevin Barry told me he started this book 25 years ago, but it has taken him this long to realize, oh, yes, I do have a story there.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's lyrical. It's singular. I'm very thankful that I had Kevin Barry read it to me while I followed along. In fact, he said he refuses to let any actor read his work. He insists on doing the audiobook. This is what he had to say about that.
I won't let those professional actors anywhere near my audiobooks. I insist on doing them myself. I'm kind of a frustrated ham actor, as you'll be aware if you've listened to one of my audiobooks. I do all the voices and I do all the accents, but I do it even as I'm writing. You know, I do act it out all the time. And even if I have like a very rough first draft, I will be kind of listening to it all the time because it's a great shortcut. You find all the evasions in your story when you hear them on the air quicker than what you would looking at them on a screen.
I just really enjoyed this conversation so much. And this is a book that the more I think about it, the more impressed I am with it and the more I like it. And, you know, the fact that I keep thinking about it is something.
That is a great sign.
Yeah.
And one that, that sort of stick-to-itiveness of a story or a character will often... I think I've said this before, often make me go back and rate a book higher.
Oh, right.
Sometimes I'll reconsider my initial rating if I'm thinking about it, recommending it, you know, long into the future.
Yeah. So that's The Heart in Winter by Kevin Barry.
Okay. Well, my next one is Brat by Gabriel Smith. And, okay. I'm going to say, you know, I love a quirky novel. You know I love a bizarre premise. We have talked about Big Swiss. We have talked about Shark Heart. We've talked about Monstrillo. All of those novels, as I'm describing them, you give me this weird look like, why in the world would you ever pick that up? And all of those novels I loved. This one, not so much, Beth. This one, not so much. This is a debut novel. It is... sort of gothic horror, but with just this very surreal... Let me just tell you what it's about. The main character goes back to his childhood home. He's at a low moment of his life, but, you know, not quite rock bottom. He's mourning the death of his father, as well as a recent breakup, and he's struggling to finish writing his second book. So we have struggling writer Gen Z... doing lots of drugs and alcohol. He gets to the house. It's kind of moldy and overgrown, so he is tasked with cleaning it all up. His parents actually are away for some reason, and they've told him to kind of clean the house up and ready it for sale. And because he's doing, you know, has nothing else to do except write a novel, he is there. It is a lot of lying around and introspection and weird fever dream style drug episodes and lots of whining. And, well, I don't know what more I can say. I will say something more about it. And that is that while he's struggling with his life and his life's journey, his skin is peeling off. Your face. I know. It is nothing like Monstrolio, let me tell you. That little piece of lung was great compared to the peeling skin of this guy. Anyway, in the description of this book, it says, I'm quoting, infused with a particularly Gen Z sense of alienation.
Huh.
I have decided that that particular sense is not one that I particularly like to read. And, you know, I was thinking about my reaction to this book. I mean, I was just rolling my eyes at this book a lot, and I didn't really give it probably the treatment that was intended. But what really bothered me more than anything were these conversations the main character Gabriel has with his brother, and they were so immature and middle school like, and there were like sort of, you know, slurs, and it was so bizarre, Beth. And I don't know why I read it. I think I hate read.
I was going to ask you what
I kept going because it was recommended to me. I'm not going to say by whom. He knows who he is. who knew I liked weird stuff.
Yeah.
And I can't blame him. He's like, you know what? You like weird stuff, Suzanne. How about this one? Well, this one might be just a little too weird.
Is it because we have our generational bias?
It is. Yeah. I'm sure it is, because I got to thinking about how early Sally Rooney sort of drove me crazy.
Okay.
And everyone loves Sally Rooney, Conversations with Friends, Normal People. I didn't hate those books at all. In fact, I quite enjoyed them, but they made me roll my eyes a little, and it is my generational bias. Yeah. I'm a little, just sort of.
Get off Suzanne's lawn.
Okay, boomer. I'm not even a boomer. I'm Gen X, for the record. And for the record, also, I loved Sally Rooney's last book, Beautiful World, Where Are You? So anyway, not my favorite. It could be right up someone else's alley, though. That is Brat by Gabriel Smith.
I'm sorry I called you a brat yesterday in our conversation. In
brat,
our
text. Oh, PTSD.
Okay, I'm going to go through my last two quickly. My next one is Juliet Grahame's. She wrote a novel called The Lost Boy of Santa Chionia. And Juliet Grahame's is editorial director at Soho Press. And I believe this is her first novel. So this book follows a 27-year-old American woman of Italian-Danish descent. Her name is Francesca, and she moves to this remote town of this remote fictional town of Santa Chionia, which is in southern Calabria. She works for this nonprofit charity, and they're going to build a preschool. It is so remote, you know, you have to cross this bridge that actually collapses after she gets there to even get there. It's treks through the mountains to find this village at all. And the day she arrives, in fact, the thing that takes out the bridge is this catastrophic flood. And with it comes, you know, in the mud and the muck afterward, a skeleton is revealed.
Ooh.
Yet nobody in the town admits to having anything about it. Yet this Francesca is approached separately by two different women who say, I think that skeleton belongs to my son. Or I think that skeleton is my husband.
Mm.
And this Francesca, because she does speak the language, she speaks English, she can translate for them, and she just all of a sudden feels like she has to solve this mystery. She does start to look into what happened to these two men, this husband and this son. Why haven't they come back to the village? And so this book touches a little bit on when people emigrate, what happens to them? Why don't we hear from them again?
Mm-hmm.
Is it that they got to the United States and met their untimely end? Did they get there and just get another wife and family? Were they sending money back, but somebody back in, you know, in your home village was pilfering the funds before the letter and the money could get to you? It was just an interesting exploration. This is very well researched, very detailed, made me want to eat a lot of the food. She explored a lot of the customs around there. And it was very interesting. You know, we're recording this on July 23rd, and today's the day that the book comes out.
Oh, okay.
And so that is The Lost Boy of Santa Chionia by Juliet Grahame's.
Awesome. Okay, my last one for this episode is actually a collection of Amazon original stories. It's called their Creature Feature, and I listened to them recently on a lark. There's something about horror in the summer that speaks to me. Like, I want to, and maybe it's that sort of wanting to hunker down inside
or
and just
the sun is still out and you won't get as scared.
Yeah, maybe. That does help, I have to say, because I listened to all of these in the daytime. but this is so last September, just before last Halloween, Amazon Original Stories released this collection of six original stories called their Creature Feature Collection. It's by six of some of today's most popular authors. So the one that snagged me and that made me explore all of them is, of course, Grady Hendrix. I love Grady Hendrix. And Beth, he has a story in this collection called Ankle Snatcher.
And is it when you crawl into bed?
It is monster under the bed. It is every child's nightmare, the monster under the bed. And it is, fantastically told. Again, these are, if you have a Prime membership, these are free on Audible and Kindle. So you can either read them or listen to them. I highly recommend the audio. They are super creepy. Just little nuggets of, just suspense, scare. They're all around an hour and a half or less total to listen to. The authors are, in addition to Grady Hendrix, we have Chandler Baker, Joe Hill, Josh Mallerman, who wrote Bird Box, Jason Mott, who wrote Hell of a Book, which is not necessarily a horror novel, and Paul Tremblay, who's a very popular horror novelist.
With him.
So those six big wig authors there doing these original stories. Josh Mallerman's story is called It Waits in the Woods, and it's this very Blair Witch-style experience where a woman goes into the woods searching for her missing sister, and there are... it's just so creepy, the voice. That's why I highly recommend the audio in this, because the voice of this particular mysterious creature is, you will never forget it. I highly recommend it. Read them now while you're inside in the air conditioning and the bright light, or wait till, October. They'll still be there. It's called The Creature Feature Collection by Amazon Original Stories.
Okay, my last one. I'm not going to spoil anything because you're only halfway through this book.
Oh.
It is called The Most by Jessica Anthony, and it takes place on over the course of one Sunday. It's an exceptionally hot day in November of 1957, but it's also told through memory because we're talking about a couple, Kathleen and Virgil Beckett. And one Sunday morning, she doesn't feel well. She says, "I'm not going to go to church with you." When Virgil and the boys come back from church, she's in the pool. Nobody's been in the pool all year. Nobody's been in the pool for years.
No one goes in the pool.
Right. But she is in the pool because it is hot and it is November. And so she doesn't want to get out of the pool. Virgil tries to get her out of the pool, tries to coax her out. And she's like, "Nope, I'm just going to stay here." And that's basically what happens during the day. She doesn't leave the pool. But we learn about both Virgil and Kathleen, how they met, their past lives, what's happened since their marriage, just through memory. Because, it takes place over the course of one day, but each tells us their story through the back and forth. But it isn't, what I found interesting was it wasn't like back and forth where one person ends, the next person takes over. We get the same story from the opposite perspective.
Yes.
And so this has a feel, I actually told her, it had a feel of a lot of the older stories we read in our
English class.
Well, our ennui story.
Well, ennui is like English class. So.
Yeah. In our short story group, I mentioned like Flannery O'Connor, and she said, she was influenced by Flannery O'Connor. And so I loved this book. It is you can read it in one evening type of book.
I'm about halfway through it. I highly recommend it as well. I can't wait to finish, which I can do in one sitting. It reminded me a lot of Mothering Sunday by Graham Swift.
Yes.
This sort of capsule or Chesil on Chesil Beach.
Yeah,
maybe.
That's another one.
This sort of moment in time being, where you are now and reflecting on all of this other stuff. And she's just floating in the water and thinking about her life. And it is beautifully written.
Yeah.
Is this a debut? No. She's the author of Enter the Aardvark, apparently.
And others.
Okay. So this is wonderful. Is it a novella, I guess?
She said you could call it a novella.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know what the actual definition is, but.
Great.
It is. I can't wait to finish it.
That was The Most by Jessica Anthony.
Those are our current reads for this month, and now it's time to speak with Jennifer Kassebaum of Flint Hills Books.
Hey, Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us.
Beth and Suzanne, thank you so much for coming to Council Grove and recording this at Flint Hills Books. It's a delight to have you back at the bookstore.
So we are talking about August releases. It's almost August. And are there any books coming out in August that you have your eye on?
There are, both nonfiction and fiction. The first book that I want to share with you is That Librarian, The Fight Against Book Banning in America. And it's by Amanda Jones. She's a librarian in Louisiana, small town Louisiana, and she has taken on this effort to ban books. And, you know, I think the September or the first week in September is National, you know, Book Banning Week. And we will, at the bookstore, be featuring some banned books in our quiet way. But it's so important, I think, to recognize that all books have value and there's a book for everyone. So
this is a book that's written by a librarian about just these efforts, especially over the past few years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She, I think, took on, you know, an effort to ban certain books in her community in 2022. And then she was targeted for her efforts. And then she filed a defamation lawsuit against those who were targeting her. And so this is a story, it's her story. And so the author is Amanda Jones.
Yeah, that is extremely timely. And what's the title again?
That Librarian, The Fight Against Book Banning in America by Amanda Jones.
Yeah, very cool.
And the second book that's also nonfiction is somewhat political as well. It's Nancy Pelosi, The Art of Power, My Story of America's First Woman Speaker of the House. And it comes out August 6th. So I'm excited to read about that. You know, Susan Page is from Wichita, and she wrote a biography of Nancy Pelosi, and it's wonderful. But it'll be interesting to see what Nancy Pelosi says.
So you're starting off with just getting political with us.
Well, you can edit this.
I love it.
But in looking at what's coming out in August, nonfiction-wise, I thought that might be an interesting book.
So who is the author of that? Who wrote that Nancy Pelosi autobiography? Okay, do you have anything else?
Yeah, I have a couple more. Yeah. Jodi Picoult, she has a book coming out August 20th. Jodi Picoult always takes on, you know, this is fiction. She always takes on an issue. The title of this book is By Any Other Name. And I've not read the advanced reader copy, but it is a story in two time periods, an author in the time of Shakespeare who actually took Shakespeare's name to write a play, but of course her identity is hidden, and then a current day playwright, female, who has the same experience. And so it grapples with that idea of being female in a male-dominated profession and what it means to hide your identity to get your work out there.
And she is a huge author, obviously.
Yeah. So it'll be exciting to see if that is a popular book among readers.
Very cool.
Another book that's coming out in August, it's at the end of August on the 24th, is Nnedi Okorafor. It's in a genre that I don't typically read. It's science fiction, fantasy, horror. But the title of the book is She Who Knows, Fire Spitter. And I think she's a pretty well-respected author in that genre. She's won the Hugo, Nebula, and World Fantasy Awards. So I think there'll be readers who are very interested in that genre that will be interested in her new book.
I actually love these. I love all of these recommendations that you've given us. I was thinking about interviewing the woman who wrote That Librarian. And so this is what I love about talking to independent booksellers, because they really point out books that you might not have already known about. And I'm curious, though, about, I wonder if you could talk to us about Flint Hills Books, because this is in kind of a summer town, if you will. I mean, Council Grove is a great town, but you do have summer people come in because you have a city lake with a lot of cabins around it. Does your store transform or anything? Does it take on new clients in the summer?
Summer is our best season at the bookstore. by far. Next would be the holidays, of course. And we're very fortunate to have the Lake residents here, and they always bring in people. There's also a federal reservoir, so there are campers, and so we get a lot of tourists that come in, but I would say we also get a lot of people who are just passing through the Flint Hills who are going to the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve. And so there are a number of readers who are looking for local authors, you know, books about this region in the Flint Hills. I try to keep mysteries and fiction in stock and the newest releases so that if people are coming out to the lake for a weekend or for the week, they can come, they can stop here, buy what they want to read for the week, and head out to the lake. But I have to say, I have a wonderful core of very loyal customers who come in, and we have book club, and we have programming now, Books and Brews with Riverbank Brewing. And we feature Books and Brews every other month, except for this fall, where we're going to have August, September, and October Books and Brews. I'm very excited about that. And people in this community will turn out for those events, and so that's really nice.
When people are asking for something local, something that gives the flavor of this region, are there books that you turn to? Obviously, these would not be August releases, but just some tried and true titles.
I always try to keep Jim Hoy, who's a professor emeritus at Emporia State University. He's written a number of books about the Flint Hills, the people of the Flint Hills, the cowboys of the Flint Hills, and he's a very popular author. Also, Mark Fiden, who's a photographer, and he and Jim Hoy coupled on a photography coffee table book, and that's also very popular. Stephen Perry, who's from Wichita, is an artist, and it's an older title, but it's a beautiful book, and it showcases the Flint Hills.
Wasn't your last Books and Brews about it with that rancher book? What was that?
Yeah, The Last Rancher by Robert Rabein. It's a Metal Art Press publication. Robert, or Rob Rabein, is a Dodge City native. He is currently the director of creative writing at the University of Indiana at Indianapolis. And this is his debut novel, and it's wonderful. Everyone that I've recommended it to has really enjoyed it. It's set in Dodge City. It's a current day family saga. Any Kansan would, I think, enjoy this book.
Okay, so we got a bonus pick this month. Is that all of your August releases?
I'm going to add one more, yeah. And you can edit this out because it's a September. It's early September release. Kate Atkinson, who I love. She's coming out with her sixth Jackson Brody book, and it's Death at the Sign of the Rook. It comes out September 3rd, and so I'm real excited to carry that.
Awesome. Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for sharing your releases and chatting with us. I guess that's a good place to stop.
I guess so. Well, until next time.
Keep turning those pages. Bye, Beth.
Bye.
Books and Whatnot is a production of KMUW Wichita. Our team of engineers, producers, editors, and hosts are Mark Statzer, Torin Anderson, Haley Krausen, Jonathan Huber, Luann Stevens, Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Suzanne Perez. You can reach us by email sent to podcasts@kmuw.org, on Twitter @BooksAndWhatnot, and on Instagram, books_and_whatnot. Find more conversations and a list of books discussed in this episode at kmuw.org.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.